Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero. Sorry, that was awkward. In 1 year flat. Oh, good start, me. Keep going. Today we are reading and discussing Book 3, Chapter 12. And before I make this intro even worse, let's get right into it. Shortly after 9 o'clock that evening, Weyrother drove with his plans to Kutuzov's quarters, where the Council of War was to be held. I noticed a lot of these chapters start with what time or what day, like after 9 o'clock is how this one starts. Previous chapter started the next day. Previous chapter started at dawn on the 16th of November. Previous chapter started the day after the review. Previous chapter started the day after Rostov had been to see Boris. Previous one on the 12th of November. Previous one, it was long since the Rostovs had news. It's a bit different. It's fell into a bit of a rhythm here. I think we just figured out how Tolstoy likes to start a chapter. Carrying on. Shortly after 9 o'clock, actually I'll start again, that evening, Weyrother drove with his plans to Kutuzov's quarters where the Council of War was to be held. All the commanders of columns were summoned to the commander-in-chiefs, and with the exception of Prince Bagration, who declined to come, were all there at the appointed time. Weyrother, who was in full control of the proposed battle, by his eagerness and briskness, presented a marked contrast to the dissatisfied and drowsy Kutuzov, who reluctantly played the part of chairman and president of the Council of War. Weyrother evidently felt himself to be at the head of a movement that had already become unrestrainable. He was like a horse running downhill, harnessed to a heavy cart. Whether he was pulling it or being pushed by it, he did not know, but rushed along at headlong speed with no time to consider what his movement might lead to. Weyrother had been twice that evening to the enemy's picket line to reconnoitre personally, and twice to the Emperor's Russian and Austrian to report and explain, and to his headquarters where he had dictated the disposition in German, and now much exhausted, he arrived at Kutuzov's. He was evidently so busy that he had even forgotten to be polite to the commander-in-chief. He interrupted him, talked rapidly and indistinctly without looking at the man he was addressing, and did not reply to questions put to him. He was bespattered with mud and had a pitiful, weary and distracted air, though at the same time he was haughty and self-confident. Kutuzov was occupying a nobleman's castle of modest dimensions near Austerlitz. In the large drawing room, which had become the commander-in-chief's office, were gathered Kutuzov himself, Weyrother, and the members of the Council of War. They were drinking tea, and only awaited Prince Bagration to begin the council. At last, Bagration's orderly came with the news that the prince could not attend. Prince Andrew came in to inform the commander-in-chief of this, and availing himself of permission previously given him by Kutuzov to be present at the council, he remained in the room. "Since Prince Bagration is not coming, we may begin," said Weyrother, hurriedly rising from his seat and going up to the table on which an enormous map of the environs of Brünn was spread out. Kutuzov, with his uniform unbuttoned so that his fat neck bulged over his collar as if escaping, was sitting almost asleep in a low chair with his podgy old hands resting symmetrically on its arms. At the sound of Weyrother's voice he opened his one eye with an effort. "Yes, yes, if you please, it's already late," said he, and nodding his head he let it droop and again closed his eyes. If at first the members of the council thought that Kutuzov was pretending to be asleep, the sounds his nose emitted during the reading that followed proved that the Commander-in-Chief at that moment was absorbed by a far more serious matter than a desire to show his contempt for the dispositions or anything else. He was engaged in satisfying the irresistible human need for sleep. He really was asleep. Weyrother, with the gesture of a man too busy to lose a moment, glanced at Kutuzov and, having convinced himself that he was asleep, took up a paper and, in a loud, monotonous voice, began to read out the dispositions for the impending battle under a heading which he also read out. Dispositions for an attack on the enemy positioned behind Kobylnitz and Solkonitz, 30th November, 1805. The footnote here says that Weyrother was reading in German and employed the new style calendar so that these dispositions were drawn up on the 18th of November, Russian style. The dispositions were very complicated and difficult. They began as follows. Oh, this will be fun. As the enemy's left wing rests on wooded hills and his right extends along Kobylnitz and Solkonitz behind the ponds that are there, while we, on the other hand, with our left wing by far outflank his right, it is advantageous to attack the enemy's latter wing, especially if we occupy the villages of Solkonitz and Kobylnitz, whereby we can both fall on his flank and pursue him over the plain between Schlappelnitz and the Theresa Forest, avoiding the defiles of Schlappelnitz and Belowitz, which cover the enemy's front. For this object, it is necessary that the first column marches, the second column marches, the third column marches, and so on. Read Weyrother. You know, the problem I have with this, just on an aside, is that he's reading a disposition ostensibly not written by the author of this book. And so the author of the book should really do an impression of how someone else would write. But that was one big sentence that went on for 9 lines, which is a very Tolstoy thing to do. That struck me as I read that. Anyway, I really shouldn't criticize Tolstoy, should I? Because, I mean, who the hell am I? Carrying on. The generals seemed to listen reluctantly to the difficult dispositions. The tall, fair-haired General Buxhowden stood leaning his back against the wall, his eyes fixed on a burning candle, and seemed not to listen, nor even to wish to be thought to listen. Exactly opposite Weyrother, with his glistening, wide-open eyes fixed upon him and his mustache, twisted upwards, sat the ruddy Miloradovic in a military pose, his elbows turned outwards, his hands on his knees, and his shoulders raised. He remained stubbornly silent, gazing at Weyrother's face, and only turned away his eyes when the Austrian chief of staff finished reading. Then Miloradovic looked round significantly at the other generals, but one could not tell from that significant look whether he agreed or disagreed, and was satisfied or not with the arrangements. Next to Weyrother sat Count Langeron, who, with a subtle smile that never left his typically southern French face, during the whole time of the reading, gazed at his delicate fingers which rapidly twirled by its corners a gold snuff-box on which was a portrait. In the middle of one of the longest sentences, he stopped the rotary motion of the snuff-box, raised his head, and with inimical politeness lurking in the corners of his thin lips, interrupted Weyrother, wishing to say something. But the Austrian general, continuing to read, frowned angrily and jerked his elbows as if to say, "You can tell me your views later, but now be so good as to look at the map and listen." Langeron lifted his eyes with an expression of perplexity, turned round to Miloradovic as if seeking an explanation, but meeting the latter's impressive but meaningless gaze, drooped his eyes sadly and again took to twirling his snuffbox. Another side note. So the narrator has admitted that the disposition is difficult to read, and in this sentence it makes note of the fact that the sentences are very long. There's a bit that says, in the middle of one of the longest sentences he stopped, etc. So Tolstoy realizes that long sentences make something difficult to read. And yet he persists with these paragraph sentences. If anyone has any insights about this this phenomenon of Tolstoyan sentence structure, please send me a link or something, and I'd love to dive into why exactly he's chosen to structure his sentences this way. "A geography lesson," he muttered, as if to himself, but loud enough to be heard. Przybyszewski, with respectful but dignified politeness, held his hand to his ear towards Weyrother with the air of a man absorbed in attention. Dokhturov, a little man, sat opposite Weyrother, with an assiduous and modest mien, and stooping over the outspread map, conscientiously studied the dispositions and the unfamiliar locality. He asked Weyrother several times to repeat words he had not clearly heard, and the difficult names of villages. Weyrother complied, and Dokhturov noted them down. When the reading, which lasted more than an hour, was over, Langeron again brought his snuff-box to rest and, without looking at Weyrother, or at anyone in particular, began to say how difficult it was to carry out such a plan in which the enemy's position was assumed to be known, whereas it was perhaps not known, since the enemy was in movement. Langeron's objections were valid, but it was obvious that their chief aim was to show General Weyrother, who had read his dispositions with as much self-confidence as if he were addressing schoolchildren, that he had to do not with fools but with men who could teach him something in military matters. When the monotonous sound of Weyrother's voice ceased, Kutuzov opened his eyes, as a miller wakes up when the soporific drone of the mill wheel is interrupted. He listened to what Langeron said, as if remarking, "So you are still at that silly business." Quickly closed his eyes again, and let his head sink still lower. Langeron, trying as virulently as possible to sting Weyrother's vanity as author of the military plan, argued that Bonaparte might easily attack instead of being attacked, and so render the whole of this plan perfectly worthless. Weyrother met all objections with a firm and contemptuous smile, evidently prepared beforehand to meet all objections, be they what they might. "If he could attack us, he would have done so today," said he. "So you think he is powerless?" said Langeron. "He has 40,000 men at most," replied Weyrother with the smile of a doctor to whom an old wife wishes to explain the treatment of a case. "In that case, he is inviting his doom by awaiting our attack," said Langeron with a subtly ironical smile, again glancing round for support to Miloradovic, who was near him. But Miloradovic was at that moment evidently thinking of anything rather than of what the generals were disputing about. "Ma foi," said he, "tomorrow we shall all see all that on the battlefield." Weyrother again gave that smile which seemed to say to him it was strange and ridiculous to meet objections from Russian generals and to have to prove to them what he had not merely convinced himself of, but had also convinced the sovereign emperors of. "The enemy has quenched his fires, and a continuing noise is heard from his camp," said he. "What does that mean? Either he is retreating, which is the only thing we need fear, or he is changing his position." He smiled ironically. "But even if he also took up position in the Thurirasa, he merely saves us a great deal of trouble, and all our arrangements to the minutest detail remain the same." "How is that?" began Prince Andrew, who had for long been awaiting an opportunity to express his doubts. Kutuzov here woke up, coughed heavily, and looked round at the generals. "Gentlemen, the dispositions for tomorrow, or rather for today, for it is past midnight, cannot now be altered," said he. "You have heard them, and we shall all do our duty. But before a battle there is nothing more important," he paused, "than to have a good sleep." He moved, as if to rise. The generals bowed and retired. It was past midnight. Prince Andrew went out. The Council of War, at which Prince Andrew had not been able to express his opinion as he had hoped to, left on him a vague and uneasy impression. Whether Dolgorukov and Weyrother, or Kutuzov and Langeron, and the others who did not approve of the plan of attack were right, he did not know. But was it really not possible for Kutuzov to state his views plainly to the Emperor? Is it possible that on account of court and personal considerations, tens of thousands of lives and my life, he thought, must be risked? Yes, it is very likely that I shall be killed tomorrow, he thought. And suddenly at this thought of death, a whole series of most distant, most intimate memories rose in his imagination. He remembered his last parting from his father and his wife. He remembered the days when he first loved her. He thought of her pregnancy and felt sorry for her and for himself. And in a nervously emotional and softened mood, he went out of the hut in which he was billeted with Nesvitsky and began to walk up and down before it. The night was foggy, and through the fog the moonlight gleamed mysteriously. Yes, tomorrow, he thought. Tomorrow everything may be over for me. All these memories will be no more. None of them will have any meaning for me. Tomorrow, perhaps, even certainly, I have a presentiment that for the first time I shall have to show all I can do. And his fancy pictured the battle. Its loss, the concentration of fighting at one point, and the hesitation of all the commanders, and then that happy moment, that Toulon, for which he had so long waited, presents itself to him at last. He firmly and clearly expresses his opinion to Kutuzov, to Weyrother, and to the emperors. All are struck by the justness of his views, but no one undertakes to carry them out. So he takes a regiment, a division, stipulates that no one is to interfere with his arrangements, leads his division to the decisive point, and gains the victory alone. But death and suffering? Suggested another voice. Prince Andrew, however, did not answer that voice, and went on dreaming of his triumphs. The dispositions for the next battle are planned by him alone. Nominally, he is only an adjutant on Kutuzov's staff, but he does everything alone. The next battle is won by him alone. Kutuzov is removed and he is appointed. Well, and then? Asked the other voice. If before that you are not 10 times wounded, killed or betrayed, well, what then? There's a footnote here, quite an interesting one, that says, readers interested in Tolstoy's own life should note that the thought of man's greatest efforts and best hopes being defeated by death, which here occurs to Prince Andrew and is evaded by him, is the very thought that revolutionized Tolstoy's own outlook on life some 16 years after he wrote this chapter. See Chapter 3 of A Confession. I'm assuming A Confession is another Tolstoy book, or a book about Tolstoy, perhaps. Well, then, Prince Andrew answered himself, I don't know what will happen, and I don't want to know, and can't, but if I want this, I want glory, want to be known to men, want to be loved by them, it is not my fault that I want it, and want nothing but that, and live only for that. Yes, for that alone. I shall never tell anyone, but, O God, what am I to do if I love nothing but fame and men's love? Death, wounds, the loss of family, I fear nothing. And precious and dear as many persons are to me, father, sister, wife, those dearest to me, yet dreadful and unnatural as it seems, I would give them all at once for a moment of glory, of triumph over men, of love from men I don't know and never shall know, for the love of these men here, he thought, as he listened to voices in Kutuzov's courtyard. The voices were those of the orderlies who were packing up. One voice, probably a coachman's, was teasing Kutuzov's old cook, whom Prince Andrew knew, and who was called Tit. He was saying, Tit, I say Tit. Well, returned the old man. Go, Tit, thresh a bit, said the wag. Oh, go to the devil, called out a voice, drowned by the laughter of the orderlies and servants. All the same, I love and value nothing but triumph over them all. I value this mystic power and glory that is floating here above me in the mist. All right, there we have it. Another chapter down. So kind of a war council chapter. And Tolstoy's taken a funny approach here, hasn't he? He's kind of gone... I was thinking about the Lord of the Rings war council where they have that meeting, you know, and my axe. I don't know what that scene's called, but I think there's a name for that scene. Anyway, Tolkien tried to make that scene as kind of exciting as possible, and it's almost like Tolstoy's gone the opposite way here, and he's made this war council scene bureaucratic, and you know, Kutuzov even just sleeps through the thing, and it's kind of like it's not even really a discussion. There's no chance that the plans are going to change. This is what's happening. I think Prince Andrei went into there thinking he might be able to say his piece and get his, you know, he thinks he's got a better plan. He thinks he can, you know, win them over. And, yeah, he walks out of there thinking, yep, nope, that was never going to happen. Laura Astrid, who I don't think I've read that name on this podcast so far. I don't think I have. Welcome, Laura Astrid, to the A Year of War and Peace podcast. Laura Astrid said, I just want to say it was pretty hilarious the way Kutuzov slept through Weyrother's explanation of the plan. I guess he knows this is how the military goes. Once a plan is chosen, even though Kutuzov seemed to express doubt about it previously, he must see there's no point in arguing. I do wonder if this inflexibility will lead to downfall. Lord Mighty Kubunga said, the whole scene was hilarious. Tolstoy was right when he called it a geography lesson with students pretending to pay attention, others falling asleep. The one with his notebook and asking stupid questions and that cool student making sarcastic comments all along. Who Was Once Delight said, I saw it less as inflexibility and more as acceptance of what he could not control. Like the terrible plans are going to go forward and he couldn't change that, but he could choose not to get involved in a meeting that would raise his frustrations, and he could choose to be well rested for the battle. There's not a lot he can do at this point to make things better, but he can avoid making it worse by being angry and tired when he will need to be at his physical and mental best. Laura Astrid responded, oh, I didn't mean that Kutuzov was inflexible. I meant the inflexibility of the Russian-Austrian forces. They seem to have this plan, and they're just sticking to it, even though several of the commanders know it's not great. Who Was Once Delight said, oh, I totally misread your question. I'm sorry. I'm not sure if inflexibility or the arrogance of Weyrother and his group will be more to blame, but I do think our best hope right now is that they're only temporarily doomed. I think an army that can quickly re-strategize and plan and come up with the best strategy even at the very last minute, that's surely going to be a strength, right? Or is there strength in sticking to the plan and going, this is what we're doing now, rather than try to change the whole plan at the last minute? If we're going to make alterations, we're going to make them to the original plan and do the best job of carrying out the plan as possible. No military strategist here, but you know, I think there might be some merit in that to say, like, it's too late to completely start again with the planning. Maybe being inflexible, there might be strength in that. I don't know. Then again, you'd think being able to strategize on the fly and come up with the best plan at the moment it's needed would be a very strong advantage too. Yet again, it's one of those let's watch and see what happens kind of moments. Wiggity Whack said, it is interesting that this chapter ended with Andrew's inner thoughts somewhat mirroring Rostov's. If only because Rostov's intense patriotism is starting to make him seem a little bit of a fanatic, and personally I like him a little bit less with each character development. The opposite has been true of Andrew. I was starting to like and respect him more. The chapter ended by revealing his motivation for glory seeming a little similar to Rostov's, yet the way it was framed seemed more endearing instead of off-putting. Like, I'm still rooting for Andrew. It seems like his intentions are in the right place. Yeah, I'm liking Andrew more and more. I like his approach to the war effort. He's not trying to prove himself a hero on the battlefield. He's trying to prove himself the kind of best strategist. And not a strategist for the sake of climbing ranks, but he wants to strategize to win the war and be a war hero, but not by fighting necessarily. He basically wants to emulate Napoleon Bonaparte and be the guy who's credited with the genius behind how the war was won. Lord Mighty Kabunga said, "Tolstoy always finds a way to ridicule one's drive. Nikolai's love for the Tsar is made fun of by his best friend in the army, Denisov. Andrei's hunger for glory is undermined by the harassment/joke in the end of the chapter made by the low rankers about the poor cook. Isn't there any endeavor that's worth fighting for?" I didn't really pick that up about, you know, everyone with ambition and drive gets ridiculed, but that's something to look out for. I think Tolstoy seems to tell both sides of every story with every character, doesn't he? He shows how the character, you know, how they think, and then he shows how everyone else perceives that character. It's kind of interesting to see. All right, I'm going to wrap it up there. Thanks very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.